Okay, let's see what we got. A question regarding the five precepts. In daily life, I'm really good about keeping number one, two, three, and five. But somehow I found that the precept number four is really hard. I think you've got company. I find myself lying every day, such as a question, do I look good? Yes, of course. Do you want to eat some more? No thanks, I'm full. But in fact, the food didn't taste good. Or speaking at a wrong time, speaking too long, too short, too harsh, or speaking the wrong tone of voice. This is the hardest one for me. Kindly advise. Just keep trying. I mean, it's the, as I said, you've got lots of company. I mean, it's not just the say the lay people have difficulty with the precepts around speech. I mean, I think in terms of the living in the monastery, then that's definitely a difficulty also. So yeah, it's just you know, we take people. I think one of the things is, you know, the reason why we have precepts. You know, of course, it's nice to adhere to the precepts, but the function of the precepts in terms of practice is to provide a mirror so that we can understand our own intentions and volitions. And that's what's really important in terms of precepts, is that we're able to get a much better kind of readout on what is the volition in the mind, what's the intention, what's the mental state. So that's it's an opportunity for learning, and that's where that you know, when we think in terms of the, what we translate as precept, it's called in the Pali. The word that's used is sikkhapadang. So sikkhapadang, pada, is like foot, so it means like the base, foundation. And sikkha is to study, to learn. So that is the basis of our study, so that we're basis of our learning. So that we're using the precepts to learn about ourselves and to learn about our minds. Okay, what is left once there is no self? Is it the same as enlightenment? Can a person still function in daily life? Drive a car, for example. yeah, I think the world would function a whole lot better if there, there were more people who would drop that sense of self and the obsessions. Yeah, it is the... it is basically a synonym or a characteristic of enlightenment, is that the dropping of the self position, the I, me, mine position, being able to yeah, but there's kind of a great fear of, you know, if I let go of self, you know, then will there be anything left? You know, fear of annihilation, fear of a kind of you know, real cessation of being, and that of course that fear itself is self. And I just think I was mentioning it last night, or anyway, and Dhamma talk, just saying that all these different teachers in the present, great disciples in the Buddha's time. They all have they've got a personality. They've got they've let go of all self and vestiges of self, but they still function in the world and then also manifest a particular temperament or personality. And then a lot of it is this, say, letting go of self is if you really want to uncomplicate your life, then, let go of self. And there, what was that, tea time? Ajahn Khrun Damo was telling of the, we had a big abbot's meeting in England. In May, from all the branch monasteries, and senior monks and nuns gathered, and Ajahn Liam was there. He's the abbot of Wat Bapaung. There's over 300 branch monasteries of Wat Bapaung in Thailand, and of course something goes wrong, and everybody runs to Ajahn Liam, and of course then all the Western monasteries, about 20 of them, some advice or something, we go to Ajahn Liam. Relate that story.
That story, that was great.
Classic Ajahn Liam, or Lumpur Liam. I think it was Ajahn Suchito who was telling the story that someone went to Lumpur Liam and asked him, what's it like being the abbot of a big monastery? And Lumpur Liam's reply was something along the lines of, I come out of my kuti and I do the things that I need to do, and then I go back to my kuti. And if some people want to call that being an abbot, well, that's their business.
It's very uncomplicated. Just a note or comment. Thank you for bringing much-needed yoga to the retreat, and many thanks to Karina for her wonderful classes and her selfless service. Okay. This is a historical question. How and when did Buddhism come to Thailand? It's hard to tell exactly. Because one, there's a in the historical record there is a record of kind of emissaries of King Asoka coming to Suvarnabhumi, sort of the golden land, which is considered Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, all the different Southeast Asian countries, sort of say they came to their country, and so that meant in terms of historical record. It's unclear, but certainly early years of the time of King Asoka, India had a a large network of trading links and trading routes that went to Southeast Asia, to Thailand, and wherever the Indians went, they had priests or monks along with them, and had their so that outposts of Buddhism were slowly sort of built up and established through in Thailand. And Thailand went through many different waves of Buddhism. You can still find the remnants of Mahayana practices and Mahayana statues and Vajrayana rituals and you know, all sorts of things. But it wasn't until about the 1200s that Thailand became a exclusively Theravada country and had all sorts of Buddhist influences over many, many centuries. Can you define / explain sankharas, mental formations? For example, what phenomena does it include? How can one evaluate what is not sankhara? How does it differ from the Hindu yoga sankharas? Actually, I have no idea of how that's held in Hindu traditions. Or even, I assume it has a similar meaning, but I have no idea what it's implied or defined by. In the sankharas, in terms of mental formations, and sankharas is used in different contexts, and it's a word that just literally means constructed, formulated, compounded. And so that it's used in the context of very general and broad. So like when we do the morning chanting, sambe sankhara anicca, all compounded things are impermanent. So that includes everything that's internal, external, mental, physical, anything that's of a compounded nature. Actually, everything except for Nibbana, so is a sankhara. But then sankhara in terms of mental formations are specifically defined within the context of the five khandhas, or the five aggregates of being, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And sankharas are then, I think there's, in the Abhidhamma, there's like 52 sankharas that are listed, and that's a sort of a broad brush in terms. So that the feelings of or emotions of happiness or sadness are sankharas, as opposed to the feeling of pleasure or pain. As it gets more complex and is a mental formation, then it's then it falls within that sankharas. It's the ability to pay attention is a sankhara. Mindfulness is a sankhara. Confusion, delusion are sankharas. Wisdom, discernment are sankharas. Loving kindness, like metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, are all sankharas. So it's the, you know, those formations within the mind that are formulations of thought, directing of attention, manifesting of emotion. All of that is sankharas. And as soon as it's, say, like with the question of how can one evaluate what is not sankhara, if it moves, it's a sankhara. Okay, I'm wondering why the chanting says, "For me, there is no other refuge. The Buddha is my excellent refuge," and the same for the Dhamma and the Sangha, when all three are refuges. Somebody's getting too refined here. Also, why are the Dhamma and Sangha referred to as Lord? Is it, you're dealing with translation of liturgy. It's not a, this is a devotional exercise. So that, it's not a left brain exercise. By Chan Karuna Dhammo's talk, so that you're trying to, one is like trying to get a translation of something that is a devotional exercise, to trying to use a language that is kind of Christian based, really. I mean, you're and in the sense of that use of Lord, the translators are English, so Lord has different meaning, really. We don't have many lords in America. So that, I mean, it's sort of something that's exalted or of worthy of kind of that one looks up to is. That's another use of the word Lord, as opposed to specifically deity-centric. So that's a lot of it is just around the, and then also trying to translate it, put it into English, and then put it into something that's actually chantable. You know, there's always compromises that are made in that process. Okay, very good. I've recently been blessed with two Loka Dhamma teachers separately teaching on the hindrances. Both suggested noticing when the hindrances are not present. Been a hard concept to recognize. Today's teachings on looking at the opposite of a hindrance when it is present allowed me to become consciously aware and look at why is the opposite not present in this moment and what do I need to release the hindrance. I guess I'm a right brain person. Thank you for the change in perspective. Okay. John Sampasana, can you please explain releasing the mind, and then in brackets again, in the context of the 12th step of Anapanasati? Thank you for your teachings. That releasing the mind is attending to letting go, putting down, on its fundamental level, because it's in the section on mind, and it's also the last step in that tetrad on the mind. So it's pointing to a certain culmination of the training with that faculty of mind. So it's a releasing of the five hindrances, so that there's a release of obstructions, complications in the mind that agitate the mind, stir the mind in some way, so that releasing. But it can also be pointing to kind of higher aspects of releasing the feeling and habit of self, the habit identification with the mind itself, so that it's just attending to. And I think sometimes using visuals or something that is, that you get a feel for what one's doing, so that as one's just breathing in, breathing out, and it's just Anapanasati Sutta, so as one breathes in, as one breathes out, just paying attention to a feeling, especially on the out-breath. I mean, naturally, as one breathes in, there's kind of, you're bringing in and holding. But then with the out-breath, there's a releasing that is physically happening. So then to tune in to that physical release that is necessary, unless all you want to do is have in-breaths, which, that doesn't last for long. So then tuning in and attending to that feeling of releasing. And then, because our mind works associatively, that's the function of perception. And so then you're using perception to then extrapolate that's not an intellectual pursuit, but the mind can extrapolate to attending to a releasing of mood, a releasing of mind, a letting go, a putting down of the thought process. There's anywhere where there's a feeling of holding or tightness, this releasing. So they're paying attention to that quality of releasing. And that's especially when one's using the mindfulness of breathing, then there is the rhythm of the breath, and then the physical natural activity of releasing on the out breath. So that Ajahn Chah used to say the practice is very simple. There's only two things to do. Just know and let go. Just attending to those two things. Knowing and letting go. That's knowing and releasing. Okay. Is my understanding of First Noble Truth correct in that it doesn't deny enjoying things in life, but points to their temporary nature and underlying unsatisfactoriness once enjoyment ceases. Can I be a Buddhist and still enjoy my chocolate? Well, talking to monks who have chocolate forms a part of their life. Absolutely. That sense of, I mean, there's enjoying things, and there is having to enjoy things, there's two different things. So that having to enjoy it is having to enjoy it, having to get it, having to possess it, having to seek it in order to enjoy. That's where it gets complicated. In enjoyment of a very simple, natural thing is quite ordinary. I always try to point to, I mean, the Buddha was very practical. In our rules of discipline, the Buddha kind of mandates and advises us using toothwoods for in those days toothbrushes and whatnot, and all the different things. I'm trying to think of that Philips thing, the electric toothbrushes.
Sonicare.
The Sonicare, yes. they didn't have those in the Buddha's time. And the Buddha, one of the reasons, there are many different, there's about five different reasons for using toothwoods, but one of the reasons is that it helps food taste better. So you keep your teeth clean, keep your mouth clean, food tastes better. That's a normal enjoyment of things. I've heard that based on the pleasure of jhana, it is possible to overcome sexual desires more skillfully. But to have samma samadhi, one needs pamoja. My heart has to battle sexual desire almost every day, and it is no less than painful to keep fighting the same battles. So in a way, I have been doing all my recent walking meditations with a little sadness over not having yet overcome sexual desire and not being able to enter jhana as easily and happily as Ajahn Kurundamo describes.
That might need a little explanation.
Well, I think one of the things, one of the problems is kind of setting. I mean, to me, it sounds like one is setting oneself up for dukkha, in the sense that I got to get rid of sexual desire, and in order to make my mind peaceful and to be happy and to experience delight, it's really a false dichotomy that creates so much tension and complication. So that, that's where the restraint of the precepts is, okay, and having a trust in oneself, one's not acting on sexual impulses in an unskillful way, and then cultivating the reflections and investigations of the, it's important to turn the mind to things that uplift and encourage the mind. If there's, it's like as soon as one is in terms of mentally or it's like when I will not think thoughts of pink elephants. what's the first thing that comes to mind? one does the same thing. If it's, one sets it up as a sort of one can rationalize it in terms of, oh, I'm a spiritual practitioner, therefore I shouldn't have sexual desire, and then you end up putting all this energy into trying to annihilate it, and this is vipava tanha, that desire for not being, not becoming, not having, not experiencing, and it's a source of dukkha. It's just part of the you have to pay attention to the balance of what are the causes of dukkha. Desire for sensuality is a cause of dukkha. And it's when it's followed and grasped after, it creates. But all the other aspects of dukkha are the that desire for being, becoming, existence. And even if the desire for being is, I want to be a calm, peaceful, enlightened Buddhist meditator. That's dukkha. and I don't want to be, a sexually aroused being. Well, that's dukkha. There's the eye sees form. And we have our senses, we have the habitual reactions, learning to understand how they work, learning to understand what their benefit is, what their drawback is, what the way out is. Looking at it from a broad perspective. And it's much more easeful and much more effective. There's more in there than I thought. Somebody has been proliferating. Imagine that, how that would happen on a retreat. Okay, there's a limerick composed on the occasion of the 2014 Thanksgiving retreat. If you're late for a sit, you must hurry in from washing dishes by a drain smelling like durian. Then you sit, till you're tied to be fit and your belly is empty to put curry in. Okay. My heart really wanted to serve you and the rest of the Sangha food today, of all days, Thanksgiving, out of gratitude, and also because I thought that food had to be directly placed in the alms bowl of a monk in order for it to be consumed. So can you please give us a quick guide on the Vinaya rules regarding the offering food and other things, requisites to monks? Thank you for your explanation so we can better serve the Sangha. It's not that we has to be, say, food has to be given, offered, in order for us to be able to consume it, to eat it, so that when we have our alms bowls, then it can be placed in the alms bowls. If it, say, as today, because just with the incredible array, much more practical to for the monks to directly receive the food, and so long as it's offered and we receive it in our hands, then we can consume it. So that's the actual offering and receiving of it in some way, shape, or form, so that either directly into the hands, into an alms bowl, other ways. Those are the most common. So that it's the actual offering rather than the, say, the vessel itself that's important. And that it's that and so that, like, for offering of food, we wouldn't be able to, you know, even if you sort of say, well, there's, please, venerable sirs, there's lots of food in the kitchen, help yourself. It doesn't quite work that way. It really does have to be actually formally offered. And that, it makes the relationship very direct in terms of a monastic. We can't really be independent. So then that sets up circumstances where, because another rule is that we can't store food, so that as monks, then we can't store, say, like, say at a Bhayagiri, yeah, there's a food shed, but monks can't go in there and touch it. It's sort of the it isn't a belonging of the monks. It's that lay people can use it to offer it. It's kept there by the lay community, so that say, like, Ajahn Yaniko, after the Vasa, the traditional rains retreat after our Katina, it went for 2 weeks, just wandering out. Started over at Fort Bragg, and started walking to just experiment. And also, there was a monk who had just finished his fifth rain, so it was an opportunity to introduce that monk to kind of wandering as a monk. And so you've got two monks, and first day, of course, you leave with a full stomach because the layperson was keen that they had food. And then the second day, sort of like, who knows? If one, you see, figure out place to spend the night, try to find some sort of shelter. They had tents that tents, I mean, they're kind of fly. They made up kind of shelters. Just enough to keep the rain off. Kind of a poncho type thing that could be pulled out. Because they actually did the morning that they left, one of the lay people took them for the meal offering in a restaurant in Fort Bragg and kind of fed them. And they got out of the restaurant to start walking up the highway, and that's when it started raining. And they had to adjust their plan. They were going to walk along the coast for some time, and had to give up because the it was rain and wind whipping off the ocean. They had to go inland because it was just so miserable. Absolutely everything was soaked. And then you have to figure out, well, where is anybody living so that in the morning then you can go for alms round and see if anybody will make food offerings. And you don't know what's going to happen. He made it. Here he is, living evidence that it works.
Ate every day.
They ate every day. Yeah, it was last year Jnaniko and Titapo went from Abhayagiri up to the Hermitage. It's almost 2 months. And there was only one day that they didn't get any food offerings. And that was because of miscalculation of the distance. So that by the time they got to a little town, it was already noon. So it was, all you could do was keep walking till the next day. Okay. Does the process of refining awareness by calming the breath and becoming sensitive to the body of more subtle layers purify the mind and body? In preparation for more subtle states? And then a P.S. A little wish to hear Dhamma from Venerable Kassapo too. His appearance of equanimity is a solid reference for me this week, Antilli. I think that was one of the conditions that he was going to come on the retreat. He wouldn't have to give a Dhamma talk.
Should have been at Abhayagiri at the exiting of the Vasa. He gave the best talk.
He gave a wonderful talk on the end of the rains retreat. Because at the end of rains retreat, the Pawarna night, one of the traditions from Ajahn Chah is Dhamma talks from the whole community except for the senior monastics who always give teachings. And so it goes sort of down the line. They usually pick the names out of the hand, so nobody knows exactly when they're going to give a talk. Then Kassapo gave a lovely talk. It's on the website. purifying the mind and body is a bit I mean, it does in the sense of because it becomes more subtle, then it becomes, say, one is shedding the layers of complication. And I would tend to not cast that or talk about it in terms of, you know, that, you know, trying to get more subtle so you can become more pure. To me, that's a trap, because there's assumptions that the mind makes around that, so that you know, a purification happens when we are ready to let go, drop, relinquish the things that stain and obstruct the mind. So it's a process of relinquishment. Okay. It's a question. How is it possible to be your student if I live far away in the Northwest? In what ways does the Vaigiri connect with those not in proximity? Vaigiri website. There, I mean, pretty much every talk that's given at the monastery goes up on the web, you know, within 24 hours usually, and it's a bit disconcerting sometimes when, you know, people come and sort of say, "Oh, I've been listening to your talks for years," they start telling you the stories that you've told.
It's also, depending on where in the Northwest, there's also the Hermitage in Burka.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Northwest. It's true.
Not sure where.
Not quite sure where. But yeah, the Hermitage is White Salmon, which is along the Columbia River Gorge. There's Portland Friends of the Dhamma in Portland. So those are places to plug in as well. Okay. Can you please explain whether there is a difference between mind and consciousness? Because everything seems to be experienced in the mind. And the body is experienced by the mind. Feelings also seem to be experienced by the mind, as well as perception, sensations, etc. Thank you for your teaching explanation. In the suttas, when the Buddha speaks of mind, of citta, then it encompasses all the different aspects of, say, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Consciousness is invariably defined by consciousness of the eye, consciousness of the ear, consciousness of the nose, conscious. So it's like it's performing a function in being conscious or cognizing the sense data, so that in the English usage or current usage of consciousness, then it has it's very broad and sort of ill-defined, so that its mind is more of a collective term, and then from Buddha's perspective, consciousness is a fairly specific function of the mind. Do the monks have any prescribed physical exercise, stretching that they do to keep limber and agile with all their sitting? No, we're born like this. <It's> yoga, tai chi, qigong, exercises of all sorts, you know, different monks will do different things, so that and different monks will have different regimes that they will rely on or try out, because there's a certain amount of stretching especially for helping to sit, then different kinds of yoga or stretching is really helpful. If you live at Abhayagiri, there's usually not any other exercise you have to do other than get back and forth to your dwelling place, because it's steep hills to walk up and down. So it's great exercise. Is having a half a glass of wine at Christmas or a special dinner breaking that precept? Does the precept mean not getting intoxicated or not ever drinking substance? Yeah, I mean, the precept is pretty clear. it's the refraining from the, what is it? Can't remember how it's phrased now. Yeah, I know. I can't remember what
it is a little bit vague. The syntax can be a little vague.
Yeah, the syntax can be a bit vague, and as soon as you get vague, then it gets... I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness.
It's the which leads to carelessness.
See, then, it sort of gets twisted a bit, so that, well, if I'm not getting careless and I'm not getting too drunk, then it's sort of okay, which isn't really how it's the actual, it's the consuming that is the precept. And... But that's the precept, and what one does with it is up to oneself. If the body is a sack of grains, my legs after 7 to 7:30 p.m. are electric jumping beans. This has occurred on retreat for 30 years. At first, I assumed it was the usual resistances, sankharas. For a decade, I've known it's a neurological syndrome that many have, more or less, although it affects other parts of life, for example, sleep. It's never so intense as on retreat in evening. As I calm and cleanse, it actually gets worse, even on longer retreats. If I don't focus on exhaling calm and metta, I would drive my neighbors crazy, twitching and squirming like a bored 4-year-old. but I'm not bored and want to hear the teachings. The level of controlling legs necessary, even with calming, creates sometimes a kind of negative piety, thunderbolts in body with no delight, rapture. I intuit an ancient root to it. But what to do? Alternative and Western guidance have not helped much. From your vast experience of squirming meditators, any advice? Any research of sitting and milder neurological phenomena like this? And right now, besides leaving the hall, tortured endurance, drugs, cutting off my legs, suggestions for a middle way. I'm trying to remember. I mean, there's a senior monk that I know who has this same, and I can't remember what he did. And I think it's whatever he did, it has helped, but it hasn't made it go away. But it's kind of helped ameliorate. So that for the life of me, I can't remember what Sachin Jayasaro. I mean he's not. How do you say he's and he yeah, and it was like, you know, evening times and he's been able to work around it, but then also there's something that he did that it really helped him. But as I said, it wasn't, and I know that it didn't completely make it go away, but it's ameliorated to the point that it's really workable. But I'm sorry, I can't remember. But it's, I think it's really helpful to know that it's a one, yeah, it's a neurological syndrome, and that there is some sort of way to help alleviate it. Although I'm just not remembering. Okay. I would like to invite my aging mother to live with my family. Our family observe the precept of no killing. However, my mother is not vegetarian. My spouse insists that everyone in the house must uphold the precept. I think it's unfair to impose that on my aging mother. Is my spouse holding on to fixed views? I very much would like to honor my filial duty and at the same time maintain harmony in the family. As a practitioner, what is the best way to handle this situation? Thank you for your time and advice. I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. I can... yeah, I don't want to get in the middle. That's a tough one, but I think it has to be sorted out, you know, in terms of before mother shows up. There has to be some kind of understanding so that everybody is actually on board. Otherwise, it's going to be real grief. So that, in some way, shape, or form, either either mother agrees or spouse agrees, or but you know, sort of there has to be. They have to take the time to see what's going to work for everybody before really moving forward. Okay. Okay, might you clarify and simplify the four frames of reference? I have read Venerable Tanisaro's book, and it's pretty challenging to remember from one paragraph to the next, as it is so wonderfully dense. Four frames especially, as it pertains to mindfulness of breathing. And I think just these are kind of categories of experience that we're already experiencing. It's already, and all we're doing is just sort of bringing them to light, so that we can clarify them for ourselves. So that just in terms of that. With that rhythm of the breath that we start to tune into, and we start to clarify our experience of the body, and then clarifying the experience of feeling, and what is the feeling tone of the experience, clarifying the actual moods of the mind, and then aspects of investigation and reflection. And so it's a framework that we're of things that we're already experiencing, but we tend to skip over them, or we tend to make assumptions, and it helps to just bring a sense of making a bit more specific. Okay, what am I experiencing? Okay. I appreciate so much the confidence you have given me to follow my own sense of what is wholesome. This teaching has really given me some much needed ease and discovery. And I think that sense of gaining a confidence in, and trust in oneself, and a confidence and trust in one's own experience. And the Buddha's frameworks or guidelines we use that as a helpful reference point, and a helpful, helps us to clarify. That sense of realizing that it's within us, and we can be doing this. Okay, I would like to add studying to my practice. I'd like to learn more of the fundamental lists. Would you recommend a book or two for starters? Thank you for your generosity of spirit. I'm trying to think of a really simple book. Something that's easily available. I'm thinking of, say, like, this is like the very old book, Four Noble Truths, Jnanatiloka, was done by, it would be on Access to Insight. It's a small book like this. And it has some very concise teachings. It's all suttas. Very concise teachings of the Buddhas, and specifically around the Four Noble Truths. That's a really good book, and it's not too overwhelming or too big. And it's something you can read over and over again. It's actually the Ajahn Sumedho's first year of his practice, and he read that dozens of times. One that's more extensive and more contemporary that gives a really good overview of the Buddha's teachings and the whole kind of structure of the Buddha's teachings. There's two books by Bhikkhu Bodhi. One on the what's it called? Noble Eightfold Path. And that's probably available on like accessing the insight as well. But then the other book of Bhikkhu Bodhi's is his very large anthology of the Buddha's teachings, called In the Buddha's Words, and so those are three very good books for getting a picture of the fundamental teachings, how they fit together, how they work together.